still under siege in Nairobi. Today, Monday, September 23rd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. More uncertainty in Nairobi as police struggle to end the standoff with militants inside the Westgate shopping mall. This reporter says she also encountered resilience and unity among Kenyans, including those at a blood drive.
A lot of people who were interviewed when they were giving out blood were saying, you know what, I just gave out blood. My blood has no color. My blood has no race. There's a unity aspect there that a lot of people didn't expect.
Also today, anticipation over whether President Obama will cross paths with Iran's new president at the United Nations.
A touch between Rouhani and Obama may only last 15 seconds. Who knows? But that is an eternity in many ways. A photo lasts and lasts and lasts.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run, at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you didn't know it was Kenya, it might have seemed like another mass shooting in the U.S. It's far away and yet feels oddly close. More than 60 people have been killed in this attack, which the militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for. And today, the shopping mall in Nairobi that was the target of those militants on Saturday is still under siege. Laura Walubengo is a Kenyan journalist with DSTV Online in Nairobi. She was outside the Westgate Mall earlier today.
There was a lot of drama today, a lot of explosions in the morning, a lot of gunshots as well, and helicopters hovering all over the place. What happened is there was something burning out of the Westgate shopping mall this afternoon, and it was smoking at the back, towards the back of the building. It so turned out there was a press conference that was done after that, and it turned out that some of the militants were trying to create a diversion so that they could escape. So I think a few of them were trying to escape, but they were gunned down. I still need to confirm those details, but they were actually trying to put up some kind of diversion so that they could flee the scene. There were some hostages freed today. The authorities refused to tell us how many exactly, and they are still not sure how many are left inside the building.
What is the mood right now in Nairobi? I mean, how is Nairobi dealing with the situation?
A lot of people didn't go to work today. It's still a bit incredulous that the siege is still going on, and we still have no clear indication of what exactly is happening in there. So the most that people could do is come together in the best way they could. And so we had even one of the hospitals, MP Shah Hospital, their blood bank was full. And so they had to turn blood donors away. So there was a massive blood drive happening in one of our recreation parks, Uhuru Park. That's what people were doing, basically positive messages on Facebook, on Twitter, trying to get food to the security officers who are taking part in the siege and also giving blood.
I mean, every city has its own character, and Boston had its own horrific episode earlier this year of violence with the Boston Marathon. Every city reacts in its own way. Is there one word or one way you can describe Nairobi's ability to kind of face situations like this?
It's just completely resilient because nobody seems completely fazed. When one person says something on Twitter that, you know, okay, this is what Al-Shabaab is saying and they're going to finish us, and somebody else says, no, you know, that's propaganda. We are Kenyans. We always stand to the end. So that is one thing that has really stood out. And a lot of people are impressed with how much we were able to unite so quickly.
The ethnic divides in Nairobi and Kenya are pretty well known. We saw how they kind of came to the surface during the elections some years ago. So is the big gulf between Kenyans who live in the shanty towns that ring the city and the wealthy who frequent these pretty affluent malls like Westgate. Has this attack widened those divides?
No, actually, it's brought it together because there were two clear messages that I can think of. During the rescue operation on the first day, at the Westgate Mall, it was mainly the Nairobi Asian community that was having a massive function there because it was East FM had a cooking competition for kids. And East FM is a Hindi-speaking radio station. So there were a lot of Nairobi Asian community over there. And so when the rescuers were going in, people would come out with kids who are Asian, and people would come out with kids who are black kids as well. I mean, it did not matter. It was just about the rescue mission. And another thing that a lot of people who were interviewed when they were giving out blood were saying was that, you know what, I just gave out blood. My blood has no color. Mm. My blood has no race. My blood has no religious denomination. And so there's a unity aspect there that a lot of people didn't expect. I think it's also because the president and a lot of the leaders who addressed the nation were busy saying that, you know what, we should not look at this as a Somali issue. We should look at it as a terrorist issue. So that is how people have thought that they should address this matter in order not to escalate any kind of violence and just make sure that everybody's okay. And a lot of people who have been interviewed, I think a lot of the local TV stations are trying deliberately to talk to Kenyans of a Somali origin to say, look, hey, this is not every single Somali who's involved in this, but it is a group of people who even the Kenyan Somalis do not really understand.
Laura Walubengo, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
That was Laura Walubengo, web editor with DSTV Online in Nairobi. While the mall siege continues in Kenya, Al-Shabaab is also on the offensive inside Somalia. The BBC's Mark Doyle is in the southern Somali port city of Kismayo and sent this report.
Kismayo, where I am, is a really difficult and quite dangerous place, to be frank with you. I'm staying with the African Union soldiers. Soldiers from Kenya and Sierra Leone have been looking after me so far. And I've been here for 5 nights, and every single night the military base that I'm on has been attacked by Al-Shabaab. The Al-Shabaab positions are, I understand, just sort of 4 or 5 miles away perhaps, and they approach this base and attack it, and then the African Union soldiers use their bigger guns, at least I hope they're bigger and they sound bigger, to fire back at them and keep them at bay. But it's not just a military situation. The humanitarian situation is extremely difficult here. You meet people displaced by the war all the time. I met a farmer called Musa Haji, who left his 7-roomed house. He had a small farm, and so he's a relatively well-off guy, and asked him why he had left his home area to live in what is a sort of refugee camp, more like a rubbish tip, really.
Shabab, they are abusing a lot of people. They are beating up, they are taking over their wealth, their children have been taken away. So because of that, they flee away from Al-Shabaab, and then they came here.
I've managed to get to one or two other places as well, always by armoured personnel carrier of the African Union, because there's a constant danger of stray bullets and roadside bombs and kidnap, or worse, really. Always travelling in an armoured personnel carrier with heavily armoured African troops. I went to Kismayo General Hospital, for example, to see the situation there, and when I spoke to the staff, I expected them to give me the usual litany of complaints about lack of drugs and lack of this and lack of that, and would the international community help? But no, the staff there and the guy in charge, Dr. Abdi Samad Haji, told me something quite unexpected. He said, no, our major problem actually is not lack of anything, but security, lack of security. The problems that doctors have when they try to decide who to treat first, how to do triage. And it really did convey to me how dangerous it is to be a doctor in Kismayo.
It might be difficult to treat your patient. He might kill you even. So the main problem is that. Or you have so many patients, one say me, the other say me, the other say me. And we are doctors, we begin with the most difficult case. So if you begin with someone, the other might take it wrong way, and he might kill you or injure you. That's the problem.
So Kismayo, a difficult and volatile place.
The BBC's Mark Doyle in Kismayo, Somalia. Pretty grim snapshot of what Al-Shabaab is up to there. Ken Mankhouse is a political science professor at Davidson College in North Carolina and an expert on Somalia. You were in Somalia this past summer, Ken. Do you share this grim assessment that we just heard?
Yes, and certainly for Kismayo. Kismayo has long been Somalia's Sarajevo, an incredibly violent and contentious place, and it remains so despite the African Union or Kenyan African Union force presence there.
So is what we've seen in Nairobi at this Westgate shopping mall, do you think that's an extension of what they're doing in Kismayo?
It's more than an extension. It's really a major departure on Shabaab's part. For years, Shabaab has focused almost all of its energies inside Somalia.
So what does it mean for you that Shabaab has taken their fight to a shopping mall outside of Somalia?
To me, it's a clear sign of weakness and desperation. When this group was strong, it didn't mess around in Kenya, in part because Somalis, hundreds of thousands of Somalis, are powerful stakeholders in Kenya's economy, major investments in real estate and business, residents there. To launch a major terrorist attack there risks all of that. And I think Shabab was careful not to do that in the past. The fact that it's willing to engage in this act of desperation now is a high-risk gamble. It's hoping that it'll prompt a heavy-handed Kenyan response and perhaps raise religious and communal tensions in Kenya in ways that allow it to present itself as the guardians of Somalis besieged by foreigners. That's really the only way it can reframe the crisis in Somalia to start to regain some of the support that it once had from Somalis. They have lost most Somali support, and the only way they can hope to get it in this high-risk gamble is by eliciting the kind of response that would allow them to essentially create a Horn of Africa version of the clash of civilizations. That's really all they've got.
How do you think the Somalis who've settled in Kenya, and there are many who've fled the fighting in their country and now have pretty significant investments in Kenya, how do you think they're feeling right now?
I know how they're feeling. They're very fearful. They're worried about government retaliation. They're worried about Kenyan retaliation. This has already been a place where there have been very high feelings against the Somalis, and it wouldn't take much to trigger communal violence there. Hopefully, the Kenyan government will continue to say the right things and pursue this as a matter of rule of law in a very judicious way.
I mean, I imagine it's more than just saying the right things for the Kenyans. What do you think the next step should be from the Kenyan government? What should they do and not do?
Well, the Kenyan government needs to pursue any and all leads to crack down on the Shabab presence inside Kenya, which is considerable. It needs to find ways to tap into Somali grievances against Shabab and let the Somalis do the bulk of the work. Ultimately, what we need in the Horn of Africa is a Somali Sunni uprising against what's left of this very extremist movement. Only the Somalis can expose the informants and the operatives, dry up the financial resources, and really put an end to Shabab. They can't count on foreigners to do it for them.
Ken, what do you think we might expect next from Shabab?
I think Shabab is going to be quite surprised at the backlash among Somalis now, and is going to be dealing with a lot of that, trying to spin it in ways that work to its advantage. And I think they're going to be retreating from areas where they're known in places like Eastleigh, the Somali inhabited neighborhoods of Nairobi. They're going to go underground because they're going to expect to have an intense crackdown on them. They are going to certainly try to engage in more high visibility attacks inside Somalia, where they've got more freedom of maneuver and movement, to try to give Somalis the impression that they've got the upper hand. But this is a movement that has had huge setbacks in the past couple of years. And this summer alone had a very bloody internal battle in which quite a few of the Somali Shabab leaders were killed. Foreigners were disaffected and left the movement. This is a group that's in trouble, and it's got to try to find a way to present a different image of itself to Somalis in the world if it's going to survive.
That was Ken Menkhouse. He's a professor of political science at Davidson College in North Carolina. Still ahead on the program, remembering a poet who died in the siege in Nairobi and his words. That's later here on The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Colombia's long rebel war may be nearing an end, but over the decades, the conflict has forced nearly 5 million peasant farmers off their land. In many cases, the land was stolen. Now the government is trying to return the land to its rightful owners. But as John Otis reports, it's not working out as promised.
Land lies at the heart of the Colombian war. For peasant farmers who formed Marxist guerrilla groups in the 1960s, one of their main grievances was lack of access to farmland. But the war made things worse. Legions of small farmers have been killed or uprooted by right-wing paramilitaries who accused them of collaborating with the rebels. Others were run off their land by guerrillas. All told, they left behind nearly 15 million acres. That's the size of Maryland and Massachusetts put together. Max Schoening is a Columbia researcher for Human Rights Watch.
So instead of a land reform having occurred in Columbia, there's been a counter land reform that's been driven by atrocities like massacres in which armed groups would enter into towns and start killing civilians, torturing them in public. And after they abandoned that land, they'd acquire it for themselves.
In 2011, the Colombian government passed a land restitution law that aims to return millions of acres to displaced peasants over the next decade. But the armed groups that stole the land in the first place are still operating in many parts of the country. These gunmen have killed more than a dozen land rights activists in the past 2 years and have threatened hundreds more who have tried to reclaim their farms. That's according to a new Human Rights Watch report written by Schoening. The land restitution law was designed to help places like the state of Arauca, where fighting has displaced more than a third of all residents. One of them is Ricardo Sanabria. He heads a group of peasants trying to get their land back. It's a huge risk to go back to your land in Arauca, he tells me. There are threats and killings. People are extremely frightened. Another hitch is that many people in Arauca have never even heard of the law. Even if they had, the closest office to file a claim is 200 miles away.
Hola, ¿cómo están? ¿Cómo me les va?
Desperate families often show up at a government human rights office in the town of Arauca to plead for help. That's where I meet William, his wife, and 5-year-old son. William says they fled their home in the nearby town of Cravo Norte 9 years ago after guerrillas accused them of spying for the government. He won't even consider filing a land claim because the guerrillas are still active in Cravo Norte. Colombian officials say that security for returning peasants would improve dramatically if peace talks, now going on in Cuba, bring the war to an end. Gloria Cuitiva, a human rights official in Arauca, tells me the land law is still so new that it's too early to pass judgment. But Schoening of Human Rights Watch says the early results are troubling.
Unless the government takes more serious efforts to curb and reduce the power and dismantle paramilitary groups and dismantle the criminal networks, it's going to be, I would say, nearly impossible to ensure that displaced people can go home safely.
That's no exaggeration. Of the 43,000 claims filed so far under the land restitution law, Schoening says that just one family has managed to return home. For The World, I'm John Otis, Arauca, Colombia.
A barkeep asks a simple question. What'll it be? For a long time, the answer here in the U.S., for beer drinkers anyway, was pretty simple, too. Something like, I'll have any one of a number of generic fizzy lagers that taste slightly more hoppy than 7-Up, please. But the craft beer movement here has changed all that, and it's inspired brewers around the world to also push the envelope. Nobody's pushed it quite so far as Scotland's BrewDogs. The World's Clark Boyd has that story.
Back in 2007, James Watt and Martin Dickey had had just about enough. Enough of their day jobs in their native Aberdeen, Scotland, and certainly, says Watt, enough of whatever beer it was they were drinking.
We couldn't find any beers that we wanted to drink in Scotland, so in 2007 we quit our day job, we got some bank loans, and massively inspired by the American craft beer revolution, we started making some hoppy beers in the northeast of Scotland.
And thus BrewDogs was born. The whole idea was to take American beer ingredients, especially hops, and American techniques, and create some seriously edgy stuff. In 2008, BrewDogs created what was billed as Britain's strongest beer, ever. Pubs banned it because the label said, in effect, everyone needs a bit of excess from time to time, and this beer, the label argued, is for those times. BrewDogs co-founder Martin Dickey enjoyed every minute of the controversy.
You know, it's a market that had been doing the same thing for tens, hundreds of years, basically, of just, you know, the same recipe, and that's all we make, and that's what people no, it's what people supposedly like, and you know, there was no real options there. So by actually, you know, having the balls to go out and make some challenging beers and beers that actually taste of something, and I think we definitely raised a few eyebrows and probably put a few noses out of joint as well.
In 2009, they went a step further, brewing a beer called Tactical Nuclear Penguin that clocked in at a whopping 32% alcohol. A year later, they made one at 55%. And while beers like this make headlines, the company keeps growing thanks to a stable of very drinkable beers, all inspired by American-style tastes and techniques. James Watt says the brew dogs aren't alone.
So you get people in Belgium, people in Scandinavia, people in Scotland like ourselves, people in Japan, people in Australia, people in New Zealand that have looked at the way that craft brewers in America in the last 20 years have toured up their rule book, have disregarded style guidelines, have come up with completely new techniques to make amazing beers. And that revolution is something that's happening now globally, and it's all because of what's happened in America.
America has, in fact, been the center of attention for the Brew Dogs this past year. They've been touring 8 different U.S. cities, brewing with some of their American craft beer idols, and filming it all. The result is a series called Brew Dogs, which begins tomorrow night on the newly launched Esquire channel here in the U.S. A sneak peek reveals that James Watt and Martin Dickey will go to great lengths to make beer. For example, in this trailer for the TV show, they float out 2 miles off the coast of San Diego to harvest kelp. Yes, for the beer.
We're now completely surrounded by kelp. I'm really tired, and I'm pretty sure I've seen some sharks. It's really going to add a cool dimension to the beer. It'll give a really nice salty note, a little bit of briny character too.
That's just the start. Here in Boston, they brew aboard a tall ship sailing in Boston Harbor. In Colorado, they brew a beer in the Rockies using only solar power. And in foggy San Francisco?
So in San Francisco, we wanted to make a steam beer, but we wanted to do it in an unusual way. So we actually captured fog with fog nets at the Marin Headlands, and that was the water we used to mash in with. But then once we'd fermented the beer, we used a technique known as hydrodynamic cavitation, and we turned the beer back into a steam, back into a fog, so people actually inhaled the beer.
Stunts aside, says Martin Dickey, his goal as a brewer is to get consumers to actively question what it is they're drinking and why.
There's never an end point, I think, in beer. It's always an ongoing learning curve and trying to do better than you did the week before.
Never an end point, eh, Martin? That's music to my ears. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
This is The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, world leaders meet at the UN General Assembly this week, but all eyes are on President Obama and his counterpart from Iran. This top negotiation expert hopes they'll meet.
You know, they've made the right noises, and it would be very much in the interest of both sides to explore this opportunity. It would be a shame to waste it.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. President Obama visits the United Nations General Assembly this week. He's scheduled to give a speech there tomorrow, but the big question about the president's UN visit is this. Will Obama meet his counterpart from Iran, President Hassan Rouhani? No meeting is planned, but the two leaders have traded letters recently, and that seemed to open the door for possible talks on Iran's controversial nuclear program. Now, previous attempts at nuclear negotiations between Western nations and Iran have yielded very little, which got us thinking, how do you even start to negotiate such a complex issue? I spoke to William Urey about that. He's the co-founder of the Harvard Negotiation Project and a co-author of Getting to Yes. William Urey, let's start with the basics. Two sides barely able to send letters to one another. They need to begin talking about this nuke business, a tough topic, so literally, how do you start? Who picks up the phone first when the two sides really can't even talk?
Well, right now they're exchanging letters, so that there's already a channel of communication. The big problem is distrust. There is so much deep distrust between both sides that in order to arrive at a good, satisfactory solution that meets both sides' interests, they're going to have to find some ways to build some initial trust.
I mean, when we're talking about nations, is it worth thinking about other more human concepts like a marriage that's on the rocks and needs saving from a nasty divorce, or is diplomacy kind of a thing unto itself?
Well, I like to think that actually negotiation is pretty much, I mean, obviously the contexts are very different, but the basic principles apply to marriages and apply to diplomacy. If you're asking, for example, who's winning this marriage, you know, your marriage is in serious difficulties. So it would be the wrong question to ask who's winning this negotiation. The question to ask is, how can we solve this problem in a way that meets your interests and ours?
So you've got some pretty practical steps about those questions to be asked that each side can take in very complex negotiations. Walk us through some of those steps.
Yeah, I think the first thing is to deal with the psychological dimension of the negotiation, the people aspect, the fact that there's been this deep distrust on good grounds over decades now. And so the motto in negotiation is, if you want to be hard on the problem, in other words, really find a rigorous solution, you've got to be soft on the people. In fact, the harder you want to be on the problem, paradoxically, the softer you need to be on the people. So in this case, it's really important to show proper respect to the Iranians, who have felt very deeply disrespected by the United States and Americans in particular over the years. And so I think the symbolism of respect is going to be very important, because it's going to be read very carefully over in Iran. Iran is a, you know, proud and ancient civilization. They deserve that respect. Respect in negotiation is maybe the cheapest concession you can make. It costs us nothing, and it means everything to the other side.
So what do you think, the protocol handlers for President Obama are kind of whispering in his ear right now about maybe a possible meeting with Hassan Rouhani, the new Iranian president, at the UN?
You know, there's a real window of opportunity. I mean, it's rare. Usually it's like, you know, there are these two windows, and when one window's open, the other window's closed. And for now, right now, you have both windows that are open. So you actually have the possibility of a negotiation that could actually get somewhere. I mean, there's no guarantee, but it's definitely worth exploring. These kinds of windows of opportunity are rare, and they deserve to be explored right away, because they don't last very long. In this case, there's a window for the Iranians, you know, maybe the first 6 months, the honeymoon period of the new Rouhani, and there's a window for Obama as well.
And William Urey, if you were in charge of setting up, kind of the first round of negotiations with Iran, what would you be telling the White House right now as far as the UN General Assembly goes?
Well, one thing is to design it. It's a symbolic moment. It's an historic moment to meet. So I would design the photo opportunity that's going to go out to the world. But I would also want to design it so that there could be some genuine conversation, some genuine getting to know each other between these two leaders, because there is a process in place, but it is a very complex process of negotiation with 5+1 powers in Iran. And essentially, if a deal is to be struck in the limited window that we have, it's going to be a bilateral negotiation between the United States and Iran. And having a personal foundation to it that can diminish the level of distrust a little bit and create the right atmosphere will be critical for a quick and speedy realization of this opportunity.
William Urey, co-founder of the Harvard Negotiation Project. He's also co-author of Getting to Yes. William, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Marco. A real pleasure.
So what happens when leaders just happen to awkwardly bump into each other in the UN hallway? That's "just happened" in quotation marks. Joel Rubin is a former U.S. State Department official who now works at the non-proliferation group Plowshares. He'll be attending General Assembly events this week. I asked him earlier how likely an Obama-Rouhani meeting might be.
Well, if you read the tea leaves about what the White House is saying, it sounds like they're not ruling it out. I think there's a lot of anticipation of some type of interaction. If so, this would be the first time in more than three decades that a president of the United States and the leader of the state of Iran were to meet. But there are risks as well. And the risks are that it would be seen as rewarding Iranian behavior without concrete results. So when President Obama does go forward, if he does choose to meet, he's going to have to also communicate how this is part of the process towards really getting results on the nuclear program that Americans are concerned about.
Let's say Syria's Bashar al-Assad shows up. I mean, it's highly unlikely, but let's just pretend. Is there some handling of that going on in the back room so that there would not be an accidental meeting between Obama and Assad? Or do you just kind of let the chips fall where they may, and if they meet, they meet?
Well, delegations are right now full of different requests they have in their inbox, trying to identify where their principals, meaning the president, secretary, the ambassador to the UN, where they should go and who they should meet with. It is highly structured and choreographed. But if Assad were to come, certainly they would be aware of it. They would know where their principal is, where their leader is, and try to make sure that that type of an encounter wouldn't take place.
There's also the case of Sudanese President Omar Bashir, who's indicted by the International Criminal Court. Now, Bashir says he's coming. What are the protocol rules surrounding someone like Bashir showing up?
Well, Bashir, if he were to be at the UN, he would have some freedom of movement at the UN. But getting to the UN is another question. And the International Criminal Court does want him there. They want him on trial.
Do you think the UN would actually want Bashir to stay away, given the bad publicity it could produce?
When an individual is running into the UN and sort of daring the UN to take action, it does create tensions, and certainly the UN does not want to be seen as not being able to bring him to justice.
I mean, this is all very big stuff at the UN and the diplomatic stage, important protocol. For Obama in the domestic scheme of things, how important is a General Assembly meeting and these brief diplomatic encounters with other heads of state?
Well, the president's going to be speaking to multiple audiences at the same time publicly when he gives his address. He's certainly going to be addressing the international community, the United Nations, as well as a particular body. He's going to be speaking to, in the case of Iran, the Iranian people, as well as the Iranian government, the leadership. He's also going to be speaking to American allies in the region, in the Persian Gulf and in Israel, who are going to really want to see where the United States is heading on its diplomacy. And then, of course, the American people who are the most important listeners to this, they're going to take it all in. And it's a very complex speech, but there's a lot of work done behind the scenes as well. So the president's work behind the scenes is going to be as important as his public speech.
What about protocol stuff that you had to deal with, Joel, in your time at the State Department? Anything that was really kind of eye-opening and just surprised you?
What was really eye-opening and surprising was how competitive it was. Every minute is precious. A touch between Rouhani and Obama may only last 15 seconds. Who knows? But that is an eternity in many ways in terms of how the public will be looking at it. A photo lasts and lasts and lasts.
All right, Joel. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
That was Joel Rubin, formerly with the State Department, currently with the non-proliferation organization Plowshares. Now, today's GeoQuiz takes us to a swanky German neighborhood. It used to be a poor working-class spot in West Berlin along the River Spree. Berlin's gritty punk bands used to rock out in the local bars and nightclubs. Nowadays, you're more apt to hear hip-hop and rap, and it's a trendy community. It attracts a lot of immigrants and expats, especially painters, musicians, and designers. Whatever the beat, this neighborhood is cool. Young people are flocking here from other countries, and the rents are rising. So can you name this trendy Berlin neighborhood, nicknamed X-Berg? We gave you a big hint there, so hopefully the answer has popped into your head. If not, here we go. Berlin has become something of a magnet for artists since the fall of the wall, especially in the neighborhood of Kreuzberg. Kreuz, or cross, get it? X-Berg. But the arrival of cool outsiders has also created tension. Locals bemoan what they call the hipster attitude, and most of all, the rising rents. Now a group of expats is trying to prove that not all outsiders are slackers. Jerry Haddon reports from Berlin.
After work recently, more than 100 Berliners cram into a dark bar, order some beers, then get straight to the point. This is an urgent meeting. One after another, residents gripe about the plague of outsiders, who they say are wrecking the city. Posers, they say, who come here, don't really work, and cause the rents to rise, forcing them out. One young man, dressed in a telltale working-class blue jumpsuit, says, "We need to attack the buildings where these rich tenants live, the buildings we can't afford." If these properties are destroyed again and again or damaged, he says, eventually the outsiders will have had enough and they'll move out. And he says rents would come back down. This guy's on the extreme end of the debate, but the few like him can be highly visible. They poster parts of town with flyers reading, "Foreigners out." After the meeting, another attendee, Susanna Grunewald, grabs her bike to pedal home. I ask her the question nagging me.
What is a hipster exactly?
It's a difficult question to answer. But I think there is a picture of a hipster which is more or less common of very young people who come to Berlin from other countries or other cities, and they come from middle class, mostly students or creatives with money.
That's a pretty good description.
Armed with this sketch, I set out to try to spot some hipsters myself. It doesn't take long. This is Mats and Natalie, 20-somethings, brother and sister. Half Swedish, half Chilean, raised in Vancouver, Canada. Mats has been here a year. Natalie's just settling in.
Well, I mean, I've heard a lot about Berlin being like a musical and artistic hub. Yeah.
And what do? Are you an artist, a musician?
I like to play music and sing. I wouldn't call myself a musician in the sense that I'm doing much with it. I'm just going to see if I can start something up here, what kind of a life I can start here.
But maybe music or the arts.
I would love to learn more about music and use my time here to learn from artists and get more into it. Yeah,
Berlin's a great city for that.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of bands and artists here. It's kind of the reason why I brought myself here.
Are you an artist as well?
I'm playing music, and I play for this drumming for this band Minceray.
The two are sitting with other expat pals at a sidewalk table outside a decidedly un-German joint called Hamburger Heaven. As for their playing guitar and singing at night on a street filled with residential buildings.
Oh, this is normal. Really, this is normal.
For them, but native Berliners might not agree. There's a word for all of this, of course, gentrification. It happens to big cities everywhere. In Berlin, it started after the fall of the wall. But in more than 20 years, no one has come even close to bridging the divide between locals and newcomers. But now a group of expats is giving it a shot, at least. They've dubbed themselves Give Something Back to Berlin. Basically, they try to get expats involved in community projects, like gardening at an old folks' home. Hannah Cleaver from the UK helps plant flowers. She saw Give Something Back's call for volunteers online.
You see an awful lot of hipster types, for want of a better description, floating around in Berlin, and the idea that some of them might be actually awake enough to realize that it's a good idea to give something back to the city was a really attractive idea to me.
And to the retirement home's events planner, Martin.
It's very good. I'm happy about it because we need more and more hands for our work here.
The founder of Give Something Back to Berlin is Anna Maria Olsson, originally from Sweden. She says in 3 months they've signed up 80 volunteers doing things from mentoring to offering cooking classes to helping refugees form a music group.
It was very important for us that it was not just going to be like, oh, let's sit in a group and like talk about the questions or like talk about social injustice or like talk about this and that, but really like, okay, but creating opportunities for people from different backgrounds and from different countries to really meet and interact.
It's the best you can do, Olsen says, because gentrification isn't going to stop. Most Berliners do understand that, and they dislike the anti-foreigner stance some neighbors take. They say you can't really blame expats for the transformation of their city. Susanna Grunewald, who attended the hipster alarm meeting, says foreigners love Berlin just like locals do.
They don't want the change. They want the Berlin they find here. It seems to be an enemy, but it's not the enemy.
Local groups have been petitioning the government to introduce rent controls, but so far at least, the city seems uninterested. Berlin has huge debts, and higher rents mean more taxes. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Berlin.
This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. As we reported earlier, the siege continues at the Westgate Shopping Mall in Nairobi, Kenya. Shots and explosions could be heard today outside the mall as police tried to corner the militants inside. The attack began on Saturday when the militants stormed the crowded mall and started shooting shoppers. More than 60 people were killed, and the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab, based in Somalia, claimed responsibility. There is a substantial Somali community in Kenya. Tens of thousands of Somalis fled to Kenya during and after the civil war in Somalia. Many settled in the Nairobi community of Eastleigh, also known as Little Mogadishu. Kevin Mwanza is a reporter with Reuters in Kenya. He visited Eastleigh to hear how residents there are reacting to the attack on the shopping mall.
At the moment, they're fearing that the military or the police will be sent to Eastleigh to prosecute them for being in the country illegally, because most of them are there and they don't have any documentation showing that they're in the country legally.
So there's a fear that they might get deported, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they may get deported or they may get arrested for being in the country illegally, just as an operation to clean up the Eastleigh. Eastleigh is a very congested kind of place. It's known for selling contrabands and sometimes even guns and bullets are sold in Eastleigh that come from Somalia. It has been neglected by the local authority because the Somalis that live in Eastleigh don't pay taxes. So the local government does not consider Eastleigh as part of where they're supposed to be taking care of their amenities, their roads, the sewage, and the general cleanliness of the place.
How many people have actually said to you, we're worried about reprisals, we're worried about some kind of vengeance against the Somalis living in Little Mogadishu?
Most of the people I talked to are not very willing to talk. It was very difficult to get someone who was willing to talk about it because they were scared. They didn't know who I was. They thought probably I could be even police trying to pretend I'm a journalist and I'm not, and then I arrest them. I talked to a young boy who was selling cell phones. Most of them counterfeit cell phones from China. And for him, he said he was really scared because he has never been to Somalia. He was born in Kenya. He came into Kenya and he was born in Kenya and he doesn't know anything about Somalia. He's never been there. So if he is arrested and sent back to Somalia, it will shatter his life completely.
How do Kenyans regard the Somali community? Do they look down on them at all?
Some Kenyans feel like Somalis are invading their privacy because they come in, one person buys one house, and then they're living like 10 families in the same house. So you have these young Somali guys sitting around, not doing any work, not going for any job, not going to school.
Is it fair to say that Kenyans see a lot of Somalis as being lazy? I mean, is that kind of a criticism?
They're not lazy as such, but they don't integrate properly with the rest of Kenyans. They tend to segregate themselves, live in groups, leave so many of them in the house. And so Kenyans don't think they're lazy, but Kenyans think they are segregating themselves from Kenyans. They're not trying to integrate themselves with Kenyans and think that we have been accepted into this country. And this is where our home is, and we should take care of it.
I mean, given what's happened at the shopping mall in Nairobi, I'm just wondering if there's already concern about police coming into Eastleigh, into this place called Little Mogadishu, and starting to really focus on the Somalis who are there illegally.
So the Somalis know that if such a thing happens, the police will come and they'll ask for documentation. Are you here legally or illegally? Do you have a foreign identification? If you don't have, probably they'll arrest you.
And Kevin, so, you're saying this has happened before in Eastleigh?
It's happened before, more than once.
Has there been any history of Shabaab members emerging from Eastleigh, from this neighborhood of Nairobi?
There is a mosque near Eastleigh in a place called Majengo that has a youth program that is known to recruit Kenyan youth into Al-Shabaab. It has been under investigation for a while, but nothing has been done about it so far because it's still opaque on exactly how what they're doing.
Kevin Mwanza reports for Reuters in Nairobi. Kevin, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, too.
Before we go, we want to take a moment to remember a poet. Kofi Awanor was from Ghana. He was 78 years old and was one of those killed on Saturday in that terrorist attack at Nairobi's Westgate Mall. Awanor was in Nairobi taking part in a four-day writing and storytelling festival, Story Moja Hai. He was supposed to speak on Saturday evening. That didn't happen. Instead, a tribute will be held in his honor tonight. One of Kofi Awanor's most famous poems was The Cathedral. It goes like this. On this dirty patch, a tree once stood, shedding incense on the infant corn. Its bough stretched across a heaven brightened by the last fires of a tribe. They brought surveyors and builders who cut that tree, planting in its place a huge, senseless cathedral of doom. Kofi Awanor studied literature at the University of London. He also spent time in the early 1970s teaching at universities here in the U.S. In 1975, Awanor moved back to Ghana and became head of the English department at the University of Cape Coast. Awanor served as Ghana's ambassador to the United Nations in the 1990s, so it's a sad irony that Awanor was killed just as leaders and ambassadors from around the globe gather for the UN's General Assembly in New York this week. One final and personal note about ambassador and poet Kofi Awanor. He was an Ewe, one of the ethnic groups in Ghana. And among the Ewe, funerals are important rituals. This is a dirge performed at Ewe funerals, recorded in 1969. We'll be back tomorrow with more coverage of the terrorist attack in Kenya and its aftermath. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.